This is WJCT News 89.9 in Jacksonville. Opinions expressed on the First Coast Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not necessarily reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. Among our topics, plans for a new Duval County jail have some concerned a larger space will lead to more incarceration. A spate of violence has Jacksonville Beach residents calling for additional patrols and limits on party permits. The conclusion of the JEA trial raises new questions about whether a culture of silence fostered corruption. And after a week of ugly social media posts, what kind of conduct should we expect from local officials online? We'll talk about all that and more with our Friday Week in Review panel. Later in the program, we talk to a Juilliard-trained musical prodigy ahead of his First Coast Masterclass. But first, here to talk about the week's biggest headlines, I'm joined by David Bauerlein, Metro reporter with the Florida Times Union. Hey, David.
Hey, good morning, Ann.
Good morning. University of North Florida journalism professor Tricia Booker. Good morning, Tricia.
Hi, Ann.
Hey. Will Brown, race, poverty, and inequality reporter at Jacksonville Today. Hi, Will.
Good morning.
Good morning. And attorney and former Jacksonville City Council President Jack Webb.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Welcome back. Let's start with a special meeting that was, a special committee that was created to look at the brick and mortar needs of JSO, including a new jail. The project has prompted a broader discussion about the role of corrections, the intersection between incarceration and mental health. David Bauerlein, you've been following closely the work of this special city council committee. Bring us up to speed on kind of where we are, what's happening now.
Yeah, this special committee started meeting last year. They should have a report soon, maybe in the next few weeks. And basically, they're looking at how to replace the current downtown jail with a new jail, likely built out on the north side. And so the basic thing they're looking at is what should, to use a bad expression, the jail of the future look like? How should it best provide the services that are going to, first of all, incarcerate people in a safe way so that they are get the medical care they need, the mental health care they need, if that's something they need. While also the big question is, well, how much bigger should it be? That's a big question as well. So it's really looking at the idea that when the current jail was built in 1990, it was a different system in place. And now we have a different mental health care system or lack of, and that's really something they're trying to adapt to as they look at this new jail. It's going to cost a lot of money. So really they need to get it right because whatever jail they build is what's going to be serving this community for decades to come.
And you've reported a little bit on concerns about what the size of that facility could mean when it's built. Explain what goes into those discussions and what some of the concerns are.
Yeah, so far they really haven't discussed very much what the size of the facility should be, which is kind of interesting that they've gone this far without saying it should be this big or that big, but obviously, one concern is that, and you hear this all the time, if you build a bigger jail, it's going to become a build it, fill it proposition, that people will get arrested and people who otherwise are not held in jail because there's no space for them. Well, maybe the bonds are set higher. Maybe they're just kept in jail. And then you have even more people incarcerated. And Duval County has a very high incarceration rate. It's much higher than the state average. When it looked at some figures from the Florida Department of Correction, it's the highest of any of the 10 largest urban counties. In fact, I think you have to go to like 17 or 18 urban counties before you get one that's higher than Duval County. So this is a community that already has a really high incarceration rate, and it's filled that jail to the brim. And so if you build it bigger, do we as a community want to be a city that just keeps incarcerating even more people, holding them in jail with all the costs that involves, the social costs? Is that really the best way to have our criminal justice system operating in the decades to come?
Well, I know that the build it, fill it is, you know, a discussion that's had. I'm not sure everybody believes that would happen, but there is some research to show that there are communities around the country that have gone ahead and built much larger capacity facilities than they currently had, and just a few years later are looking to expand again.
That is correct. The thing that I keep coming back to when I read and learn about this is something that Rockman Johnson said during one of the recent committee meetings, was that the jail is the largest mental health facility in Northeast Florida. That alone should give everyone pause. And it's something that especially with recent legislation that has been signed by the governor about unhoused people and potentially being something that could have them thrown in jail. You know, if you have someone who's unhoused or if you have someone who has mental health concerns, they could find themselves being in jail, and there might be now more space for them to be in jail if there's a larger facility. So the whole build it, fill it is a very real concern. And especially with, I would say, unfunded mandates from the state, you know, this is this new law that was recently signed. It could have unintended consequences for local governments and local jails across the state. But, you know, we're the ones who are considering building a bigger jail at the moment.
And poverty is very much a factor when it comes to our incarceration rate. I think that the Charlie Cofer, who's the public defender, was at that recent meeting and saying, you know, these are people that if they had a friend that they could call or a family member that they could call to get that $150 bond or that bail money that, you know, that would allow them to bond out, they would, but they don't.
That's 100% correct.
And so it becomes a system that is skewed financially.
Correct.
I think it's worth noting that although our needs have changed since 1990, these problems have not changed. I mean, we still back then, the vast majority of people in our jail system suffered from mental illness. Still back then, the vast majority of them could be out on bail had they had a friend. I mean, 83%, according to reports, of people in our jails have not been convicted of anything. Mm-hmm. So I see them wanting to move forward with a bigger, better jail, but I haven't heard any talk of, well, what have we been doing wrong for the past 30 years that we could change? That to me is missing from the equation.
That's a good point that you make, again, because this is a pre-trial facility. Again, the individuals who are arrested may very well have priors, but for the matters for which they're incarcerated, it's pre-trial, so they haven't been convicted. On the political side of it, I think it's interesting. I think the mayor is doing a good job in kind of giving this to the council to wrestle over and come up with some ideas, because the last thing in the world you want to do is turn it into a courthouse fiasco, where that becomes a political football and it drags on for years.
Remind us a little bit about that fiasco.
If you remember, it started, the plans for the courthouse originated under Mayor Delaney, and it turned John Payton inherited it, and it was just a debacle. And it was divided the city for years, and the council for years.
Cost
kept increasing. So, yeah. Rip the Band-Aid off, give it to the council, get consensus on the council, and then the mayor just has to sign the bill and get it done.
Why do you think there's appetite for this discussion these days? I mean, obviously, the jail has been, you know, kind of in a capital improvement project in the future for the council and for the city for a long time, but it really does seem to have a new kind of traction.
I think it's a confluence of events. Number one, you've got downtown redevelopment. So there's been a lot of talk for a long time about getting the jail off the riverside, okay, off the riverfront. Number two, we need it. So there is need for a new facility. And again, there was talk years ago about using that infrastructure, the basement area, for an aquarium of some sort, of something like that. All sorts of crazy plans. But I just think the time is right. It's got to get done. And the time is right for downtown redevelopment as well.
We're talking about the week's biggest headlines with our panel, Week in Review. We're welcoming your calls and comments as well. You can give us a call at 904-549-2937. You can also send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also watch our program right now. It's live streamed on Facebook and the WJCT YouTube page. We have a call. Tom on the West Side. Good morning, Tom. Go ahead.
Good morning to you. I have two thoughts on this. First, as you just alluded to, there are alternatives to incarcerating so many. We could, of course, end cash bond, which would get a lot of people out of jail. We could also go to civil citation, so sheriff after sheriff has opposed that. Also, from a security standpoint, the current jail is superior to the campus style that's been discussed because of the large perimeter that a campus style would have to have, which would have to be secured. And as we're already spending money to renovate the old jail, maybe just reducing population and fixing up the old jail entirely might be the more fiscally responsible thing if we can just minimize the population in the jail.
David, I want to ask you about that. I mean, they are talking about going horizontal rather than vertical in this new design, the campus style he references. The current jail is considered really outmoded in terms of the need to take inmates up and down a lot of floors to get to where they're going, as opposed to just sort of on a lateral trajectory. But it does come with additional land requirements, certainly.
Right. No doubt about that. And the experts who have been bringing their presentations to the committee have all said, basically, you're better off doing a campus style environment where it's spread out, as opposed to doing this one where you have it's almost a mid-rise building in downtown. That seems to be a real strong consensus that comes out. You do need more land. That's why somewhere is a rural area on the north side seems like most likely place. You know, the comment about cash bail is interesting because that often gets brought up. And a lot of states have moved to do more ending cash bail, which is, you know, where you don't have to actually put up the money. And if you're poor, you're able to get out just as someone who has more means can get out while you're awaiting trial. But in Florida, not surprisingly, the legislature and the governor last year basically put an end to that even being considered in Florida. And it used to be every judicial circuit could kind of decide on its own what the bail would be. And so you had some that were moving more in the direction of allowing people a lower hurdle to get out of jail. I think South Florida was moving that way. And the governor of the legislature came in and said, no, there's going to be a uniform standard across the whole state. The Supreme Court came up with those uniform standards. So the idea of cash bail is pretty much ending cash bail in Florida, unless there's a change in state law, is not happening. So that does sort of make it a little bit harder to create reforms that might make it help people who are otherwise not at risk if they're out of the jail to be able to get out of jail awaiting trial.
And the issue of civil citations. I mean, there's been, I think, some support from our local state attorney, less so from the sheriff. I mean, there is a juvenile civil citation program, but when it comes to adult civil citations, which basically is a diversion program, Will, this sheriff has basically said if you do, you know, an adult crime as an adult, you're going to get grown up time.
Yes, he's said that almost verbatim. I think it's almost a paraphrase of play stupid games, win stupid prizes. Something along those lines. But
I want to ask you more specifically about the idea of compassion or kind of more humane treatment of inmates. And one thing that Councilmember Johnson brought up when he was talking about his, you know, a lot of these guys have gone to visit other facilities, and that's been an important part of their education. But he said that in Orange County, the approach that they used was almost like a waiting room, you know, like at a DMV, instead of this booking process that we think of as being very restrictive and formalized and in kind of chains, handcuffs, but that they really put people in a room. They are called to go to the various stops that they need to. And that unless somebody acts out, because there is this presumption of innocence, like Jack says, that there is not necessarily a criminalized treatment of people. They're allowed to make their phone calls. They're allowed to, you know, kind of get booked in, but not be treated as less than.
So it's fascinating. I had a family member of mine who was in the jail for about a month last year, and I didn't go into all the details with them because, I mean, it was, I could tell on their face and kind of their body language is a bit traumatic. Their charges were dropped, so they weren't convicted of anything. They were arrested. They just spent a month in jail. And the thing that I took away from this family member, who's maybe a couple of years older than I am, was an emotional toll, more so than, I mean, yes, they were arrested on charges and the charges were eventually dropped and it was a nonviolent situation, but the emotional toll of just being in the jail, it felt to them they weren't treated as respectfully as they would have as an adult, as a person. And that was something that, you know, I think that whatever Jacksonville does with its next jail is something that really should be considered. I mean, obviously, like Michael Boylan said, you know, hardened criminals should be treated like they're hardened criminals or accused of harsh crimes. But for those who have not been accused of violent crimes, their humanity should be considered a little bit more as we go through this process.
And that humane treatment, I mean, I, what Health and Human Services activists are saying is, look, you're talking about all this improved mental health treatment. Are you going to take away our funding and not stop allowing us to fund mental health for people before they get into trouble? I think there's great concern around nonprofits that that's going to happen as
you
well.
You mean if they're diverting money from other mental health resources in order to create kind of an adjunct mental health treatment center at the jail?
Yeah. So instead of helping these people before they get into trouble, wait till they get into trouble and then say, oh, look, we've got some services for you now that you're in jail.
What is the sense, Jack, of putting mental health care in the hands of a correctional institution? I mean, they are talking about creating a separate facility that would address the needs of people who do have severe mental illness and not treat them as criminals, treat them somehow differently, but it would still be under the umbrella of corrections.
Let's look into our crystal ball here. I think it ranks right up there with privatizing or healthcare in the jail system. Okay. We all know how that's worked out. Okay. Because that's where it's going to go. Because you don't have staff who's capable, competent to do that work. So you're going to bring in a third party, right? You're going to outsource it. It's going to be a profit-based organization. That's the way it's going to work, and it's not going to work ultimately. Don't do it. Keep it the way it is. Fund the nonprofits. Fund the entities that have the capability, capacity, and the desire to do the job.
Mm-hmm. David, I'm going to ask you about that. Cost is a big part of this. One of the ways that they're talking about bringing down the cost is by increasing the amount of medical facilities and resources on this new campus, however it is built, so that they wouldn't have to be basically shuttling inmates back and forth to UF Health, which is what they do now. And you discovered a really significant cost attends that transport. So this theoretically would save some money.
It would. And I think the city council auditor, at the direction of the city council president, Ron Salem, did do a look into how much the city is spending. It's millions of dollars just for the transportation costs between the jail and UF Health. And so it would make sense to have an infirmary that's full scale that can really treat inmates there within the corrections facility, as opposed to all that cost of shuttling them back and forth for things that do not require inpatient treatment, hospital stays. So that could be a cost savings there, and it would be probably better healthcare as well. The more accessible healthcare is, the better it is. And the more immediate you can get it, the better it is. So that's something that they are looking at, is building in a much larger infirmary into this new jail to provide that need.
So if the jail is the largest mental health facility in Duval County, does it make sense to just kind of create an adjacent facility to handle that? Or are they exploring any larger solutions to that problem of people who have mental health issues and end up in trouble with the law?
Yeah, it's a great question. My understanding is that the sheriff's office does not want to be the ones who would actually run that facility, but it would be under correction. So I guess someone is there held against their will. I mean, they're incarcerated, and during their incarceration, they are rehabilitated or given mental health access so that they will not have the same issues that got them picked up in the first place. I think that's interesting. It's really not been fleshed out. It is not a new concept, because I think this is something that jails across the country are moving towards. So there should be some models out there that they can follow. But those are all great questions. And Jack brings up a great point. Who is going to actually run this facility? What will its goals be? How does that work when you have somebody who is incarcerated being forced, possibly, to undergo mental health treatment?
And law enforcement did not choose to be the largest provider of mental health care in the county. I remember having numerous conversations with John Rutherford about this when he was sheriff. He said, we don't want to be in that business. That's not what we do, but it's forced upon us. So in adopting this kind of model, you're accepting the status quo, however flawed it is, and just institutionalizing it as we move forward. I mean, I just think a lot of additional thought needs to be put into this.
Yeah. And talking about a facility, Tricia, that's much larger, possibly, or at least more spread out, requiring more humane treatment, perhaps more attention, all coming at a time when it's really hard to find correctional staff. I mean, we're having shortages, not just locally, but statewide, nationwide. So the idea of creating a facility that would actually require more employees might be a tall order.
Yeah, and it's not a fun job. I mean, you don't, it's the reason we're having so much trouble is because the mental health of these guards is really at risk.
And their safety.
Their safety. It's not a particularly high-paying job. And there have been examples of these very expensive jails being built around the country, and then they sit empty because they can't fully staff them. And you cannot have open a jail that is not fully staffed when you're going to be filling them with people who are potentially mentally ill and could cause more, even more problems than they are now.
We've got a call. Daryl from St. Augustine. Good morning, Daryl. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Yes, your Duval County Jail is the single most dangerous place in all of Duval County. Mixing hardened criminals with a nonviolent, like your guest just mentioned, is what the jail does. You need to have some sort of separation of those people. I had an employee who told me, I'd much rather be in prison than in jail. So, you know, because the hardened criminal was on their way to the judge, and the person who maybe was a DUI or something else is in the same place. And my family member called me, and I was forced to pay a little over $100 a day on some mysterious cash app to ensure that this person made it through the evening every day. So there was extortion going on out of the jail.
Yikes.
Daryl, I'm more than happy to pay it.
Thanks, Daryl. That's a kind of a shocking reality. But I will say recently there was a death penalty case that I'd been covering where the inmate was transported for, you know, kind of an appellate, you know, an appeal type thing here in Duval County, and was actually filing motions to be put back in prison, saying that the conditions at the jail were so dire. I mean, this is a person who lives on death row. So it kind of gives you some context for that.
This was back in 96, I think. I was a writer in residence at the Duval County Jail, and I was teaching creative writing to teenagers. So they were minors who had been charged with adult crimes, but were still in the jail with adults. And some of the stories they would tell me, I'm not going to say they were good kids because they had all been charged with crimes, but they had not been convicted. And they were scared. It broke my heart to see these 16, 17-year-old kids who were having to hang out in jail with people who were teaching them more bad things, I guess.
Right. And just one other note, I mean, there is this push to try to get people who are aging out of the system. Has that been discussed much, David, in terms of, you know, the costs of health care that attend these aging populations? It's probably not as big a deal at the jail, but there are a lot of people at the jail that need cancer treatment, dialysis. I mean, there's a lot of expense that goes with people who are older and sick.
So far as I know, that is not something that has been brought up in the discussions in terms of looking at that particular aspect of the cost of operating the jail. It's an interesting question. They really should look at that, I would think, in terms of how they're going to handle that situation. I don't know that that's necessarily up to the design of the jail so much as it is how that's handled by judges in terms of deciding how to dispose of cases.
Yeah, right. Well, I want to move on to talk about a different issue that was in the news this week, violence in Jacksonville Beach. Spring break celebrations were disrupted by gun violence. One person was killed. Three others were injured on Sunday. It was a day that included St. Paddy's Day celebrations and huge PGA crowds. Three nearly simultaneous shootings. It prompted a lockdown, an active shooter alert. Tricia, you live at the beaches. No doubt a scary incident. I'm not sure anybody was terribly reassured to learn that rather than an active shooter situation, this was actually three separate individual shootings.
Yeah. It was crazy. I don't know how much TPC played a role because it was still going on at the time that crowds started gathering. The chain of events, one of the chains of events that led to one of the shootings was this guy, DJ Showtime, who apparently had been advertising for all of these people to come to the beach and that maybe that we would be doing these Oklahoma drills and I might bring boxing gloves. And so people come prepared for this and they're excited about it. And then DJ Showtime says, well, I got to the beach and then I changed my mind about the fighting. I decided there wasn't going to be any fighting. Well, already there are hundreds of people gathered and people start having fun. And then he leaves and goes to Buffalo Wild Wings. And all of the people are still gathered there with no kind of organization and start fighting. I don't, this seems to me, and the police said that they were aware that this was going to be happening. It just seems to me that some of this could have been prevented.
Well,
an Oklahoma drill requires a specific set of aggression to want to do it. So for those who don't know what an Oklahoma drill is, it's well, it used to be very popular in football, but it's in football practices, it's not anymore because it causes head issues. But essentially, it's two people lining up anywhere between 8 and 10 yards apart, and you're either trying to get past the other one or you're trying to physically dominate someone. Mm-hmm. And you're running at each other at almost full speed to try and physically impose your will on someone. And that is what happens in football pads. Mm-hmm. It hurts when you do it in football pads. Ask me how I know. So for people to do it just on the beach with
in bathing suits
and no padding, I mean, yes, it's created some viral videos elsewhere. There's a famous quarterback who was on the wrong side of an Oklahoma drill about a decade ago, but I digress. But it requires an amount of physical aggression that it's not something like, oh, yeah, I'm going to have an Oklahoma drill. Like, that's one of the reasons I wouldn't let my son play football now, because mm-hmm. of things like the Oklahoma drill. So to do it without football pads on is silly.
I want to ask you, Will, because one of the elements of the discussion that emerged after this, and it was actually from a Jack's Beach business owner, but he was quoted by our news partner, News for Jax, talking about this being the result of an outside element. He specifically said, what happens when we have the bigger events and the weather is good, a lot of people from the inner city come and create chaos. Obviously, the video showed a lot of African-American teenagers and young people on the beach. This, I think, could become a difficult discussion for Jacksonville Beach when that is sort of the go-to narrative that was, you know, the night of the event.
I mean, I think back to the discussion about the Orange Crush events, mm-hmm. where there was all this, oh my gosh, Orange Crush is coming. We don't know what kind of element's coming here. And it was completely peaceful. So, you know, some of the same people who are going to go watch the Freaknik documentary on Hulu this month, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, most of the time it is completely peaceful. And it was a large gathering of people. Yes. Were there some people who were, you know, charged up with adrenaline and because of things like an Oklahoma drill and the potential for boxing? Yes.
Alcohol as well.
Yeah. Oh, goodness.
A lot of
yes.
liquid courage there.
Yeah. A lot of it. So I guess I'm saying is people should not be so quick to label large gatherings of people for the small and silly actions of a very small minority.
At the same time, Orange Crush was a lot more organized. Yes. It was an organized event. This was not. There was no permit pulled for something like for this at all. And if there people are saying, well, now we should get a permit for anything over 20 people. Well, that's ridiculous. If there had been a permit pulled for this, there would have been a more organized police presence, and everything, I think, could have been a little bit more calm.
I know for a fact, because I've worked with Jacksonville Beach government on their public events policy a number of years ago. I was representing Lynch's Irish Pub, and they did a bunch of stuff out there. And maybe it just needs to be readdressed, because you got a great point. My understanding of their ordinance code is that you need insurance, you need permits, you need police presence, you need this, you need that. And so I was kind of stunned. There's more to come from this, because number one, there were three shootings. Not all three occurred at this one particular event. So what else happened out there? But what was this in a parking lot? Was it on the beach? I mean, who was responsible for this? And if they didn't have a permit and it was an illegal gathering, then it should have been dispersed prior to somebody getting hurt. But that said, this is, you know, it's like the Kansas City post-Super Bowl parade. You know, people were thinking, I may not want to go to this thing because of the fear of violence. Well, that's society we live in anymore, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Can I just add that, you know, it's really important that while we're having this discussion, we don't forget the name of James Jones III. He was the person who was unfortunately killed mm-hmm. during this event. He's 21 years old. He played football in his youth. He recently became a father. So now there's a young, very young child who now doesn't have a father because of foolishness.
Stupidity, yeah.
I feel like I kind of sidestepped your question, Anne, about the racial component. And I think that you make a really good point. The whole idea of outside people coming to Jacksonville Beach, that's just ridiculous. I mean, the Jacksonville Beaches area belongs to everyone. Mm-hmm. And I feel like to connect this particular incident one night with, oh, now we've got to stop letting outside people come to the beach is just kind of ludicrous. It's sure. A red herring.
Yeah, I mean, all of Florida goes to the beach, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to just raise the issue of what had happened in Miami pre-spring break, because you do get a sense that there's going to be a little bit more question about permitting for events and kind of cracking down generally. They ran an ad right before spring break.
We need to talk.
This isn't working anymore.
And it's not us. It's you. We just want different things.
Our idea of a good time is relaxing on the beach.
Hitting up a spa.
Or checking out a new restaurant.
You just want to get drunk in public and ignore laws.
So we're breaking up with you.
This March, you can expect things like curfews, bag checks, and restricted beach access.
DUI checkpoints, $100 parking, and strong police enforcement for drug possession and violence.
Whatever it takes, because it's time to move on.
I want to ask you about that, David. That's an interesting approach that they took. It actually got a lot of national attention, I think, that ad campaign about breaking up with spring break. But they did really crack down. And that is something that periodically, you know, municipalities around Florida have done. Daytona, Fort Lauderdale, Panama City. I mean, there's been all these places that kind of were hotspots. And then there was a big reaction and a crackdown.
You know, if they want to do bag checks, just make sure everybody's bag gets checked mm-hmm. and there's no profiling going on. And, you know, and if people who live at the beach are willing to have their bags checked, I don't really know exactly how that works. You know, it is, I think it's just shocking that people are bringing guns to the beach. It just feels completely wrong at some level that someone says, I'm going to go to the beach, hang out at the ocean. And by the way, I'm going to bring some guns with me.
My AR, right.
And, you know, I really don't, not an expert in terms of how they did it in Miami. They obviously are saying this is an image we once had going back way back when, spring break Mecca, go to South Florida. I don't know how you enforce all those things without it being to some level selective. I mean, are people going to have a wristband that says I'm a resident, so don't worry about me, but outsiders, they're going to get some extra level of scrutiny. And it just feels like a very difficult thing to police at that level.
Certainly $100 parking would be prohibitive.
That would be a
prohibitive for a lot of people. We're talking about the biggest stories of the week. You can call us or reach out on email or social media. We're at 904-549-2937. Brad at the beaches. Good morning, Brad. Go ahead.
Is this about permitting or is it about preparedness? Because we had St. Patrick's Day, the Sunday of TPC, and the first weekend of spring break. As I understand it also, they've had trouble accessing the $500,000 worth of security cameras due to the cyber attack. I do think there's a lot of questions to be asked about Jack's Beach's preparedness for this event and not just the actions of what happened.
Thanks, Brad. You know, the law enforcement out there has said that they were prepared, that they had extra patrols because they had seen these social media posts about this big party. And I have seen that law enforcement there said that their closed circuit television was working, but they have reached out to the community at large to see if they can help with that. I mean, even though they had their CCTV, they're looking for contributed video, and they are still looking, obviously, for the people involved. But Will, what about that? I mean, is this the kind of thing that you think that the beaches community feels like they dropped the ball on from a law enforcement standpoint?
It sure seems like it from a distance, because with all of those things going on, and this is not to, this is, let me make mention, no, this is not to blame law enforcement. This is to blame the people who are organizing law enforcement. And what I mean by that is, like the caller mentioned, it was a confluence of things that would bring a lot of people to the beach at one time. So it is better to be prepared and nothing goes down than to have something like this where there are multiple shootings in a wide open space.
Mm-hmm. Also, Tricia, I mean, there's a lot of guns out there.
There are a lot of guns out there. But in terms of the preparedness, I'm going to compare what happened to Jack's Beach to what happened in Ponte Vedra the same night in the wake of TPC. They had cops every quarter of a mile pulling over people to check for DUI. Mm. They knew this was going to happen. The security was unreal. To me, it comes down to money. I'm sure TPC coughed up a lot of money to get more security in there and to make sure that nothing spoiled the general aura of PGA golf. There was, again, there may have been increased security, but there was not increased availability, I don't think, for law enforcement to be in there. Why wasn't anybody stopping these Oklahoma drills? I mean, can that be legal for people to, like, be voluntarily assaulting each other?
It might not be consistent with the permitted, with the permit that was right. issued. Who knows?
There was no permit.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
Well, I want to move on. I want to talk a little bit about JEA. So this is a story that it seems like will never be far from our minds. The criminal case is now over. The federal prosecutor in this case, Tyson Duva, says there will be no more charges filed related to JEA. So it's done from that standpoint. But David, as your colleague Nate Monroe pointed out this week, JEA didn't happen in a vacuum. Even if others weren't criminally complicit, they did participate in a culture of silence that allowed or perhaps even encouraged this, you know, outrageous behavior that occurred.
Yeah, part of the testimony from a former chief operating officer, Melissa Dykes, who was not indicted but was one of the witnesses for the government, was the whole thing seemed pretty scripted to her. And I think that's fair to say that we all saw it as scripted. And, you know, people were not spontaneously quoting John F. Kennedy. Everybody was reading off a script. The board members were kind of came with their prepared one-liners. And I thought it was, so.
You're talking about like the meeting where the sale was approved.
I think from that point, you know, people were not vigorously asking questions and airing out what the full scope of, they weren't aggressively asking questions in the meetings. And then I think in terms of the culture of silence for the whole organization, I think Paul McElroy, the former CEO, came back as interim after this debacle, kind of said there was just sort of complete moral collapse that took place and that there was just people were just not, were sort of going along with it. And the culture of silence was basically people weren't raising the concerns. They weren't asking the questions. They weren't asking really, is this what we're really all about? And so I think that was a real problem this agency had. And, you know, if a board's not going to be independent, then what's the point of having a board?
Jack, in terms of the culture of silence, you know, we have heard a few stories from city council members. We've had Randy DeFore on recently, your former colleague, Matt Schellenberg, also who was a former city council member, both describing, you know, when questions were raised either by them or by other people, that they were really just shouted down. I mean, that literally Matt Schellenberg described being taken into a room by Curry's mayor, former mayor Curry's then chief administrative officer, Sam Musa, and screamed at to the point that people were able to hear in other rooms. And he was told that if he didn't fall in line and didn't stop asking questions, that he would never get any more money for his district.
Gee, I'm surprised. I'm really shocked. Honestly, it doesn't surprise me at all. You know, David and I were talking before we went online, before we went on air. You remember the bystander effect, Kitty Genovese, the murderer in the Queens, New York, back in the 60s. And this is kind of like, it's kind of like that in a sense, that subordinates, you know, at least at the JEA staff level, they're afraid, the group is afraid to object or to raise issues because, again, they'll get retaliated against, like Schellenberg. You know, we're going to cut off funding from your district. So it's easy to kind of look away and said, all right, you know, we won't do anything. Moreover, you know, David's right. I mean, we have a strong mayoral system, but that doesn't mean that the council doesn't have a role in vetting the quality of the individuals who comprise these so-called independent boards. They're not there to rubber stamp what the mayor wants. They're there to run the agency, and that did not happen here. But no, I'm not surprised by that at all, that there would have been serious arm twisting going on. In fact, if you read the council report that was prepared by Smith Halsey, there are some specific references to objections made by community leaders that were met with threats in the hallway by Aaron Zahn himself. You know, hey, we'll cut your contracts, we'll do this, we'll do that. So it does not surprise me at all.
Tricia, not to draw parallels to what's happening on college campuses, but I think it's become more clear to people in recent years, months, the pressure that can be exerted to silence people and not just people inside City Hall.
Yeah, this to me, this ties in with one of my biggest pet peeves, which is people not knowing what's going on around them. I mean, if there was a moral collapse within JEA, to me, there's a collapse of the sense of civic duty among people. This didn't happen in a vacuum. It also really didn't happen in front of the public, because the public isn't aware of what's going on because nobody reads the paper anymore. So if people are doing great journalism, but nobody's reading it, is it great? You know, we're talking a lot about the effect that social media has on the mental health of kids. I'm really interested in the effect that social media is having on the ability for people to know what's going on in their community and at least speak out to try to prevent some of this from going on. Because I do think there's so much happening in local government that nobody is paying attention to because nobody is aware of what's going on around them.
David, do you see this case as kind of a victory for justice or a defeat in the sense that there were so many people involved in the machinations of this that were untouched by the investigation?
No, I think it was a victory for justice. I mean, it's not against the law to put your public utility up for sale. The case was about this bonus plan that would have created huge amounts of millions and millions of dollars for top executives if the sale went through. And to the extent that people were part of that conspiracy, they were investigated, and they had two people who were put on trial for it. So I think it was a victory for justice. And the report by the City Council Investigative Committee was able to go way beyond just was a law broken, to really show that this was a vast effort by a lot of people to try and steer the direction of this sale. So I thought it was a victory for justice. I didn't think that anybody who was criminally culpable got away with anything in this. And I think I thought it was a comprehensive look.
Good point.
Between those investigations.
I want to turn now to the subject of public officials on social media. It's one of those topics that we always seem to kind of hold our nose and ignore. But there were a couple of really stark examples that happened this week. One exchange involved derogatory name calling by City Council member Rory Diamond in an exchange with his colleague Jimmy Peluso. Former Mayor Lenny Curry also posted an extremely profane tweet in response to what seemed like sort of a fairly mild provocation. Someone asked about his former friend and now convicted felon Aaron Zahn. Jack, what are officials thinking when they do this kind of thing?
Apparently, they're not thinking. Nothing good happens on Twitter after 7:30 p.m., apparently. So, guys, I mean, what about government in the sunshine? Oh, Lenny's not the mayor anymore. He can post whatever he wants on Twitter or X, whatever it is. Peluso and Diamond, come on, guys. Somebody's got to be the adult in the social media world. You know, come on, pull up. Show a little dignity, for God's sakes.
I mean, so both of these gentlemen later deleted their comments, but not before they were captured, right, and redistributed.
You don't have to explain what you don't write. Right. Remember that.
Well, and the mayor's words were also immortalized in a fake Mother's Day card meme rather quickly, given the nature of his comments. David, I mean, it's funny, but should we expect better?
Yes, absolutely, including from the former mayor of Jacksonville and current city council members. I just think it's just bizarre, and it does not reflect well on them or the city to have these kind of comments. I mean, the Curry quote thread, it starts with him quoting something by an 18th century philosopher, Joseph Butler. I kind of plugged the quote in. Oh, that's interesting. So kind of high-minded, food for thought. And then within a few days, it unravels to this profanity-laced tweet, and that's sort of both sides of the Curry social media persona. But surely he can get away with not doing these ridiculous things. And then being in turn ridiculed by putting his tweet into a Mother's Day card. I think people can kind of get the gist of what his tweet was about. I just think it should be a higher standard for people who have represented this city when they're on social media. Absolutely. And they should stop it.
Well, on that note, finally, it is time for our lightning round. Tricia Booker, let me start with you. What's cooking in your world?
My good friend Patty Peoples, who had to pay $40,000 to repair her house after squatters occupied it and was successful in changing Florida law to make it easier to evict squatters, flew to Texas this week to film for the Dr. Phil show. So she and her squatter law are going to be on the Dr. Phil show soon.
No kidding.
Wow.
How exciting.
She's a Springfield resident, yeah.
Will, what's going on in your world?
So this weekend is the Jack's PopCon. It's at the downtown library, considering how much discussion there has been about books and access to books, especially at the public library. It's going to be from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the downtown library. There's going to be family-friendly books and comic books and games and television and pop culture references. So I will probably be there with my special correspondent. So if you see me, say hello.
All right. Jack Webb, what's going on with you?
All things March Madness. Go Gators. Mm. Go Gators.
They need all the luck they can get.
Yeah, we're going to the Final Four, baby. Let's make it happen.
How about you, David?
So speaking of University of Florida, you know, we've been reporting for a while they want to build a grad center in downtown Jacksonville. And the latest thing is they also are putting Jacksonville at the top of the list right now for the Florida Semiconductor Institute. So UF could be doing a double dose of academics here in Jacksonville, and that's in addition to the UF Health Medical Center, so a real strong connection being developed and added on between Jacksonville and the University of Florida.
Excellent. Well, I just want to say that this month, after the Hard Rock Casino launched its sports betting app in Florida, calls to the state's compulsive gambling hotline doubled, up 100%. Nobody's surprised, but if you need that helpline, it's 888-ADMIT-IT. David Bauerlein, Tricia Booker, Will Brown, Jack Webb, thank you all so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And up next, we talk to a 27-year-old musical prodigy, 22 years after he started college.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
Join WJCT and the Florida Theater for Daniel Tiger Live this Sunday, March 24th at 2 p.m. Daniel and all his friends are hopping on the trolley coming to see you. More info at wjct.org/events.
Can Donald Trump pay his $454 million bond? Time is tight for him, and it's tight for congressional leaders, too. Can they meet Friday's deadline to pass a $1.2 trillion funding package to keep the government open? Also,
we will continue to use our arrest authority and arrest people coming across the border illegally.
A legal back and forth gets pushback at the border. That and more on the News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. I'm joined now by a musical prodigy whose early accomplishments started really, really early. Llewellyn Sanchez Verner is just 27 now, but the pianist and composer started college at age 5 and started performing with orchestras at age 6. Llewellyn, thanks so much for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure to talk to you.
How does one even begin to get started that early?
Well, you know, I had a piano in the living room. And I just was obsessed with it. And my mom wanted to show me all forms of the arts, but she encouraged me to follow my passion of the piano. And then, yeah, just she found that the pacing was a little bit different with the school that I was trying to attend. So I went, had interviews with administrators, tests with faculty members, and they let me do college classes at Ventura College. And I was lucky to have such a robust and well-rounded education. So then when I went to Juilliard when I was 14, I was able to focus much more on the arts.
So when you're doing college-level classes at age 5 and then an orchestra at age 6. I mean, when do you start reading and when do you start, you know, when did you actually start playing the piano?
I started playing the piano when I was 2, actually. Okay. Yes. It started out as a raw love just for the magic of the instrument. But I think later on, I realized that it was really how I wanted to contribute to society and both from the stage and through social advocacy through music.
And so how do you realize how unusual it is, right? I mean, it is so, so unusual that you have that kind of early passion and commitment.
Well, I just like connecting with people and hearing what others have to say. I really enjoy that music has allowed me to travel to so many countries in the world and just hear people's perspectives.
So talk about your social advocacy, because that really Sure. is a big part of your identity and the work that you do.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I had the real privilege of going to Baghdad, Iraq, to play with the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra. And this is just one example of sort of how I see this. We had a cross-cultural exchange happen there. We performed for Iraqi civilians, for American soldiers, ambassadors from various countries. We played Iraqi, American, and European music. The conductor had a pistol in his coat pocket during the performance. There were bulletproof vests being used by orchestra members. But there was this absolute commitment to giving back to their community. And we raised money for the Children's Cancer Care Clinic there. I think that it's so important to realize that as artists, we have a platform to transcend cultural and political barriers, and that we can use the substance, the joy of music for a larger purpose if we try.
And you've performed for a couple of U.S. presidents, I think yes. Barack Obama, the current president.
Biden, that's right, yes. And also the presidents and prime ministers of Mexico, Rwanda, Singapore, and Ukraine, yeah. Yeah.
And so great opportunities. When you are in those settings, how do you connect that with your advocacy? How do you, and what are some of your passion projects?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, passion projects. I love that I have such a diverse heritage, first of all. You know, I'm an American. I'm an all-American boy, but I've got, Mexican, German, Ukrainian, Jewish, Welsh. I've got different things. So, you know, recently I did a project, Dia de los Muertos, just all about Day of the Dead. Had lots of Mexican, legends, revolutionary leaders, poets, historians, all featured in Catrinas with skeletons, choreography around me while I was playing, Mexican folk and classical music. You know, just a way to sort of make that bridge into different communities and increase a lot of empathy. I think that I love performing concertos with orchestras around the world, just the music for music's sake. But any chance, again, to tell stories and reach people's hearts, I love doing that.
We've got a little of your performance. You're doing Bach's Chromatic Fantasia and Fugue at the Louvre in Paris.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Anything you want to say before we give it a listen?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I'll just say, look, I loved performing at the Louvre, really an amalgamation of so many different kinds of art forms, right? And with this Bach, just the improvisatory nature, the free nature of the piece, I always find so interesting, complex, and wild. Yeah.
All right, let's hear a little of that.
Sure.
It's just beautiful, Llewellyn. So you're not just stopping by to visit me. You're actually in town to perform. You're going to be at St. Paul's by the Sea Episcopal Church in Jacksonville
That's
Beach.
Right.
That's tonight at 7:30.
Yes.
What will people hear and see when they come to see you?
Sure, a diverse array of music. We'll have Haydn, Stravinsky's Firebird Suite, the piece that made him famous. With the raucous infernal dance, the beautiful pursues, the big finale. We'll have Debussy, estampes, postcards, prints from around the world. Chopin, one of my own pieces. I think that it will really be exploring different innovators of the piano through the centuries, and just how exciting their contributions were. Yeah, so it'll be tonight 7:30 with the wonderful Beaches Fine Arts series and Kathy, who's been a joy to work with, a really remarkable individual.
And what kind of composer are you? What kind of music do you create?
Sure. I think music that is accessible and tries to reach people's hearts, absolutely, with a lot of rhythmic flair, and something that if at all possible, speaks to the voices of today. I think that I love film music. I'm very much inspired by Hans Zimmer, Danny Elfman, John Williams, some of the ways that they've been able to bring movies to life with their scores. And yeah, just again, telling stories. That's what I love to do.
Well, Llewellyn Sanchez Werner, it's so nice to meet you. Extraordinary accomplishments for such a young person.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you so much for having me.
And he will be performing tonight at 7:30 p.m. at St. Paul's by the Sea Episcopal Church in Jacksonville Beach. And that's our program. We welcome your feedback, comments, or suggested topics. You can just email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Today's program will be rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight, and all of our shows are archived at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey Bennett. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer, and our director is Brady Corum. Don't forget to listen Saturday at 4 when neurologist Dr. Joe Servin speaks with Jacksonville's chief health officer about battling emerging epidemics in the Sunshine State. And join us again on Monday when we hear from students calling out what they call, quote, an epidemic of sexual harassment and assault in our schools. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.